when you're reading a script, I love reading between the lines. I love like finding, you see this actor said this specific thing, so we need to make sure that we are changing the lighting here and emoting this, and you know, like finding those nuggets that create moments of real awe in a show. Those are like the exciting pieces for me.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Business of Entertainment podcast. This podcast is dedicated to shining light on those who work behind the scenes in film, TV, theater, and live events. My guest today, Hunter Weinschenk, hails from the desert land of Arizona. Hunter is a director, actor, and improviser who has been a part of theater across the US, UK, and Israel. I first worked with Hunter on the production of Rumors by Neil Simon, put on by the Stage TLV in 2021. After our first collaboration, I can say that without question, Hunter is passionate about creating new theatrical experiences and being an absolute rock star at his craft. On this episode, we're going to discuss a lot about Hunter's unique processes of creating a show and what it means to be a director of live theater. Enjoy.
All right, it says it's recording.
All right.
Well, welcome to my podcast. It's a working title called The Business of Entertainment.
It's a good name.
Maybe. I don't know. Like I said, working title. I just came up with it. You want to? But the icon that I came up for the podcast?
Maybe The Art of the Business of Entertainment? Wow. Or the business of the art of entertainment.
How many words can we fit in? Have you heard of that ridiculously long podcast that no one wants to hear about?
Is that the name?
No. No, it's not.
You could also call it, Are You Not Entertained?
Exclamation point?
Exclamation point.
I like it.
With a question mark afterwards.
What about instead of that emoji? What emoji could we put on the end of that? Are you not entertained?
I always like one of the dancing people. Or you could go along with them. The thing is, when it comes to entertainment, there's not a whole lot. You know, you have the comedy and drama faces, and that's kind of it, at least from a theatrical point of view.
All right. So you know the metaphorical monkey talking on the phone?
Yes.
Okay. My wife came up with a way better concept than that, and we found an artist on Fiverr to draw it.
That's awesome.
So from someone who has no idea about, you know, a set, a production, how they function, and then they hear a phone call with like a producer or a director, I know those were words I understand, but I have no idea what this person
but
said.
But I'm not sure what's going on. That's really cool.
Yeah. The whole goal of this podcast is to just talk with people, producers, directors, and anyone that's below the line of that, crew, artists, about what has made like great productions for them.
Right.
And like how they interact with and what is their role in terms of the connection to director or producer. Mainly towards producer, because that's where my long-term focus is.
Nice.
So if I'm not doing that in 10 years, I feel like I slipped up.
Okay. I like that. It's good to have like a specific goal. I find that for myself, I oftentimes am more focused in like what I'm doing right now, for better or for worse. You know, sometimes I think it can be really good to have like an eagle eye focus on what you're doing and doing it the best that you can.
Yeah.
But I also do see that like when people are like, you know, when you go to a job interview and like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I'm like, honestly, in an apartment, rent controlled if I'm lucky.
Rent control does not exist in this country.
It does not. No.
Oh, no. This is like an example as to why rent control was put into as a law.
So that people don't end up with astronomical rents in a, you know, shoebox. I actually used to live, fun fact, I did actually used to live in the basement floor of a comuna with six guys. And various partners and children and animals.
That's so many.
It was a lot.
That is a huge list.
The thing is, it was a really nice, renovated, gorgeous place. And I had the smallest room, which was a closet. Like, it legitimately used to be a closet that they tried to rent out. And I took it. And so I was in the basement floor. I had enough room for a bed and a wardrobe, and that was it. And my window looked up to the entrance, and it had bars on it, like a prison cell. And I paid a respectable amount of rent for that lovely Tel Aviv apartment.
Whoa.
But we had really good parties, and we had a projector to watch stuff on, and like an outdoor area. It was three stories. It was awesome.
Dude, I've said this to so many people. I am very pro going to find, like, go find yourself.
Right?
Huge. And coming here and seeing how much that can happen. I'm not saying, like, oh, you come here and you find yourself as wanting to be this or that, or like whatever it is, however you find yourself and what you want to do. There's a great, it is so liberating to just be able to do that. And hear so many stories from other people that have come here and done that too. There was one guy that I met. We finished a production at Suzandolo. We went out in that area. What is that area called?
In Florentine? No, Nevitzedek.
Nevitzedek. We went to a restaurant in Nevitzedek, and somebody who knows somebody came by with somebody else. I don't remember these names.
Okay.
Guy sits down at the table. He apparently won a 1-year all around the world trip from like Discovery or something. It was one of those people.
That's ridiculous.
I forget, but we were talking about his journeys and this and that. He went to Thailand to learn how to Muay Thai fight. Like, dude, that is so crazy. Awesome. And when I asked him, like, was it worth it? He said, talk to me in a few years. I'll let you know.
It's one of those things that's like compounding interest, you know?
Yeah.
You find yourself and then you're like, well, I found myself. And then 2 years later, you're like, oh, okay. But I do think that those experiences help die, you know, create the person that you are.
Oh, absolutely. For sure. I had come here wanting to do an internship in film and television. And
where?
Do you know anyone who went through these programs? I don't need to name names. There's lots of different programs. So I'm not going to shout out. And
when you say internship, it's...
it is. You will work for free.
100%.
And I hope you like it. But holy cow. We had... I didn't ask for it. I didn't say... I wasn't on an order form where I could choose. I got an apartment, Kikar Dizengoff, third floor. Like, you know the white building next to the movie theater?
Yeah.
That building.
Nice.
In the summer.
And you were paying a respectable rent?
It was part of my program. So
they gave it to you.
That's
shit.
What I got in my program. That whole building basically had some people just living there permanently,
that's
some actual
crazy.
Residents, but it was rented out mostly for my program. Yeah, and one night, one of us was super drunk, and we were trying to figure out where he was, and he got up on the roof, and he was like, dude, I'm on the roof. We're like, there's a roof? After that, I shit you not, we put together, basically every Friday, a potluck Shabbat dinner on the roof, chilling. And me and Dimitri were cooking for most of the people. This guy who I befriended named Dimitri, shout out Dimitri, makes amazing borscht. Is a fun dude. I actually wrote the 10 rules about Dimitri. You know how like the rules of what's his name? The student of Bruce Lee. Why can't I think of it? Chuck Norris. Like the rules of Chuck Norris.
Okay,
when
yeah.
When Chuck Norris jumps in the water, Chuck Norris doesn't get wet, the water gets Chuck Norris.
Right.
Yeah. It was fuck. No, I just got lost into too many.
You wrote the 10 rules.
Oh, yeah. 10 rules about Dimitri.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wrote the 10 rules about Dimitri that were basically like that. And anyways, me and Dimitri.
What was the rule, though?
I don't remember. I could pull it up. You want me to pull it up?
I think you should.
All right. While I pull it up, I'll keep talking.
Okay.
So,
at least we won't get borscht, you know?
That's true. Got him. So, where would I find this? No. Facebook. There we go. So anyways, me and Dimitri cooked for most of the people, and like whatever you want, we would figure out how much it costs, and we would say it's 10 shekels or 15 shekels. You eat as much as you want. There's no like, oh, can we do 5 and I get half a plate? No. If you want to eat what we're making, we would every day make food for like 10 people.
That's awesome.
And when my program ended, I was actually I stayed in that building because I was offered a job. Let me rewind. Hang on a second. What am I searching for?
It's crazy how many people, you know, and I don't think it's actually specific to Tel Aviv. I think it's one of these things that it happens in a lot of big cities.
Yeah.
Where you meet a couple people and you just start kind of creating, I don't know if it's a routine or a life or, you know, whatever you want to call it, but I found it too, where suddenly I meet people who live here, and it's like, you know, every Friday they have the routine, they go to their family, they do what they grew up doing, and then you meet all the new immigrants who are like, oh yeah, every Friday I go to this potluck on this guy's roof and we eat random shit. And it's really crazy how like different it is for those of us who have emigrated or moved over.
It is. It really is. I never thought I was going to do it. It wasn't like a plan for me.
No?
No. Why can't I search my Facebook page? I hit search and then it's posts I've seen.
Maybe it's too meta. But
Maybe. Ah, he wants to be my friend. Okay, he can be my friend. I don't know why I can't find him. I can't find him and I can't find the post. I'm screwing this up.
It's okay.
Anyways, we had the rules of Dimitri. We at one time we were where we were living. Beit Lesson was still in the theater, right? Like in that same
in the previous location. Yeah.
Yeah. And one time we found a half broken couch outside of the theater, and I picked it up and carried it, and we put it into the apartment on the Mirpeset. And then while Dima and I were drinking, we were just chilling and talking. And I was like, hey, man, I think we could fit this on the roof. He was like, won't fit up there. You can't get it through the hole. And I was like, nah, I think we can do it.
I've heard that before.
And I was like, listen, let's give it a try. It's not that heavy. Because I carried it myself from the theater to like one whole block.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big deal. And it wasn't small. It was like this, at least a little bit longer than this table.
Humble brag, yeah.
Yeah, humble brag. So it was easy for us to try and pull it up. It fit, like it was touching the sides as it went through,
mm-hmm.
but we got it up there. And then we had a couch on the roof.
That's awesome. I don't know if you were with us when we were doing Rumors. Were you with us when we got the couch? The black couch that we had on stage?
I don't think so.
So a few of us went, one of the girls who was the assistant stage manager donated an old leather couch to us.
Okay.
Which, first of all, was a lovely donation, but second of all, old leather, like old leather, when it starts to chip and then no longer looks black. And
yeah.
So we had to somehow get it down the stairs, and I think it was four people. This fucking couch was so heavy, and in those narrow staircases where it was hugging the side all the way down, and our thought was, it's only a, you know, her place is a 15-20 minute walk from the theater. We'll just carry the couch on our backs all the way over to the theater. And you know, it didn't seem like a bad plan at the time.
Wait, it's a 20 to 30 minute walk.
15 to 20 minutes.
15 to 20 without a couch.
Yes.
So, like an hour.
So my logic was it would be a 15 to 20 minute walk with a couch on our backs, you know?
You just made it an hour long journey.
100%. Luckily, one of our lovely volunteers, Judy, just showed up with a car, and we were like, we can make this work. So we just threw it on top of the car. Actually, I think we threw it in the car and just let the trunk open with half the couch sticking out and drove slowly and got there. Yeah, it was it was one of those things that took much longer and a lot more sweat than you expected it to take. But that's just because you were too optimistic when you were looking into it.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing. When you have free things, you're like, yeah, I'll do whatever it takes to get it. It's free.
That's true. Especially when you're brand new here and you don't have money.
100%.
Yeah.
I've lived in multiple apartments too where the couches have just been off the street. You know, you Lysol it or whatever the equivalent is.
But some people put some nice shit out. Like I was
for
when
sure.
I lived on Pinsker, like right near Bialik. And dude, like some people put like a really nice ass like hand-stitched couch that like old from like the '60s.
Backpedal, hand-stitched couch.
I like embroidered. Oh, okay. Hand embroidered.
For a second, I was like, I crocheted this couch.
Did you crochet the wood, sir?
Yeah, 100%. It would take a very long time, but actually, I have a rug in that room that I did crochet. As a fun fact, yeah.
Dude, I built my own bed.
Out of crochet?
No. Even more romantic. It was the first set, the first day I worked here was on Nickelodeon Stutnik.
Okay.
When they, at the end of the season, got rid of the show, they were done with that set. They put it out for recycling. I was allowed to take whatever I wanted from there.
That's awesome.
I took every day by bicycle enough wood back to Tel Aviv to build myself a bunk bed.
And is this the bed that your daughter currently uses?
No.
Okay.
And there was a futon underneath the bunk bed. So I had a futon where I could sit on down below with a dresser. And then I had a bunk bed where I slept on.
So it was like only the top bunk. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just the top bunk. And then there was like this weird, like, I don't even know how to like make this triangle. I've never seen such a weird triangle in my life. It was a corner of my room. But the other wall, so it was like this weird triangle, then this, and then like the wall came down. It was fucking weird. Completely weird. And I was like, wait a minute, I could build a triangle shaped desk. So I brought back, I measured how much like the space is, and then at work, I cut a triangle piece and then bicycled that back and made that my desk.
That's very impressive.
I bolted the bed to the wall by each post.
Okay, I was about to say, like, were you ever concerned on a bed of your own making? But
nope.
Seems pretty good.
I was very happy with it. The reason I remember is it came up in my feed yesterday, like 10 years ago today, and it showed the bed upside down. Actually, that is something I can show you.
I don't know if I like those or hate those. It was 10 years since this happened.
I'm loving it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm most of them. I am looking at like one day party, next day work, one day party, like club.
Well, and it's also good because it's not like you're posting like 10 years ago. I was, you know, like dead in a ditch. Like you're not posting the shitty things. So you're like, ah, good memories 10 years ago.
Here we go. Making a custom bunk bed, a work in progress.
That's awesome.
Yeah. June 9th, 2012.
2012.
Yeah.
You're the world
Dude,
was supposed
look
to
at how much metal hardware I put on that bed for that wood and metal to connect to each other. You asked me if I was concerned.
Look, yeah, you can't say you weren't safe with it.
I try and practice what I preach with safety.
Yeah.
I try to.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
You don't want to end up with a I remember, like you want everything to be secure and don't want anyone to die.
No. No. I don't even want to get into that aspect of production life because that's just horrible and sad.
Yeah.
No show's worth dying for. If it's like for me, rule number one, make it safe. Rule number two, have fun. Because if you're not having fun, why the fuck are we here? Go work in a cubicle.
100%. I also think though, like I will say that danger sometimes does pay off. I did see Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
I talked about that in my first podcast.
Yeah. I saw it on Broadway and I was beyond enamored, and I thought it was fucking incredible.
What?
Yes, I
it was a good show.
It. I loved it. I saw it when I was in high school, granted, but like it was, and there was only one almost fall of like one of the Spider-Men. But
why weren't they connected with the right safety harness?
No, they were connected, but it's like, you know, they go over the audience.
Yeah.
And then they go all the way back and they have platforms that they stand on. One of the guy lost his balance on the platform. So he was on the harness. He would have been fine, but then like someone grabbed him and pulled him on. It just would have taken you out of the show.
Yeah. An actor falling directly in front of you almost to his death. Yeah. That takes you out of the show.
A little bit. Yeah. But it was a great show.
Dude, Cirque du Soleil actors do that stuff with no harnesses.
Yeah. But that's like their lives. That is what they're trained for. I think it's a little different than I'm a Broadway actor, put me in a harness, you know?
That's what concerned me about it when looking back at like what happened with that show. And I researched who were the actors that played each Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to find who were like the, you know, people like to broadcast like their logos on big productions. Like we did this for this, whatever, whatever. So it's easy to find some of this. And it's just looking at who is a part of this. And then I look at something like Cirque, where they do these shows, you know, at before
day
COVID.
Day in, day out,
44 different shows around the world, touring and resident shows in multiple countries. I think 22 of them were in Vegas simultaneously.
That's incredible.
Multiple shows, over 10,000 shows.
That's really incredible. I think.
Dude, that is an incredible feat. Have they had injuries? Yes. Are so few. You could literally, the reason you can bring them up is because there are so few. You know who they are.
Yeah.
And what
happened. Also, I think the people, if you say I'm gonna go do Cirque du Soleil, it's because you feel pretty confident that you're not going to get hurt in your day job. Because if you do, you're out of a job.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you know, if I get hurt working at my desk, well, I'm not going to get hurt at my desk. But if I get hurt, I can still go to my desk.
Yeah.
If you get hurt during this, it's like an athlete. You know, in any case, you can't play the game anymore.
What you can do is become a trainer. You can be some other things. There are the
others. True.
But honestly, though, even the people who do this, like, they literally scout Olympic gold medalists. Like, that's one
for
of the...
For Cirque du Soleil?
Yeah. Some of their
Doesn't
athletes are
sound
Olympic.
Like a step down, though?
How do you know? They see what they do is they find people who are Olympic gold medalists and like, oh, you got a gold? All right, you're good enough to train with us.
Okay. I hear you.
I don't know. I'm not saying that's how it works.
I think it
would be hilarious if it was.
Do you actually know Reeve Carney, who played the original Spider-Man, like the main Spider-Man, not the stunt Spider-Man, in Turn Off the Dark, was also the original cast lead for Hadestown. He played Orpheus. You familiar with Hadestown?
Didn't see Hadestown.
I didn't see it, but I watched a lot about it, listened to the music. I really, really, really liked it. As far as the amount that I knew the show, hopefully I'll see it if it's still playing come the next time I'm in the States. But it looked like a really awesome show.
What shows do you like going to? Because I would love to go to a show that you want to go see.
So in general, I'm actually going to London pretty soon for work, and
I will not be going to London pretty soon.
No, but I am gonna go see the show that goes wrong.
Dude, they did that here in Israel.
They did?
You didn't see it?
I didn't. No.
It was with Beit Lesson.
When did they do it?
A few years ago. I worked on that show.
And was it? Amazing?
I didn't know what I was doing. Like that day, I'm like, I'm there. It's just like it's not my show to run, but it's one of their shows. So I'm an assistant for the head of whatever that day for lighting. So I would be around while they were building it. After you build it, you have to then test everything. Yeah. I was completely unaware of what was being tested and for what. I was legitimately scared things were going to fall
that
on
things
me.
Were breaking
yes,
and you didn't
I
know
I was
why.
Like, things were breaking. I didn't know why. And I felt like, dude, the first time, like a flat, like one of those and caught by a chain, I'm like, oh my God.
You want to talk about a show? I haven't seen it. I've only seen, you know, parts of it. But you want to talk about a show where like the tech is really the art in that case? I think that's a perfect example because you have to build that set to fall apart. You have to build it to break.
You do.
And then put it back together. And that I think is something really cool. But if you want to ask about like shows that I like seeing, I'm very torn because I like musicals, but unpopular opinion, I don't love them. I like listening to them.
Really?
But I will prefer a play over a musical.
Interesting.
Because I really, and it's also part of me as a director, but I really look at the acting, the stagecraft as an art of something that you can really focus and you can really see. And I tend to feel that in musicals, there's a little bit of hiding behind song and dance.
Ah, I see what you're, in terms of story.
Sometimes in terms of story, but I think of it almost more as in terms of the ability of the actors. You know, like you have to say, I'm putting on this musical.
Yeah.
And I need to cast a group of people. I need them to be able to sing at a certain level and I need to be able to dance at a certain level. And oftentimes I feel that the acting becomes secondary. that you say that, like, yes, it's important that they're able to emote and get what I need out of them. Mm-hmm. But the wow factor that the audience is going to remember is the high note that they hit and that wow. Yeah, the wow moment, the dancing of the entire ensemble. And you can often hide behind an ensemble as well. That's not to say I don't like it. I think ensembles are really incredible. And I love, love, love some musicals. I think it can be done very well.
It can't. What you're saying is it can be a cheat code depending on how you use it.
A little bit, yeah. And all as a director, where I'm really focusing on the original writing that I'm getting and the actors and making an audience feel something.
Yeah.
And this may be because I'm not a musician, but I do feel that it's like it's almost like an easy hack. You know, like it's an easy way that I still love going and seeing musicals. I think oftentimes I leave a musical going, I want to go on stage and do that. You know, like it makes you feel really, really strong. Some musicals, and like some of my favorite musicals are Hairspray.
Who doesn't like Hairspray?
Everyone loves Hairspray. And
the original one, though, not the new one, way better. The movie,
yeah, the original. And I also think
I've never seen it in live though.
I saw it live actually here in Hebrew. And this was the funniest thing for me. I saw it. I was only in Israel for a year. And at mm-hmm. the time, my Hebrew was absolute shit. But it was a gift from like a work employee. And they took me with them. And it was actually the opening night. And I didn't know. And there was only one row of seats that were sold to the public. And everything else was invite only. And we were in that row. So we were surrounded by a bunch of Israeli stars and whatnot, who I didn't know at the time. But whatever. And because I know the show so well, didn't matter that it was in a different language. I enjoyed every minute of it, and I got every joke, and I understood the thing because I know that show. And so that, I think, was great as far as a musical goes. I tend to, I think, in musicals, veer a little bit more towards comedy, whereas when it comes to plays, either I'm going to go full farce. You know, like, I love one of my favorite plays of all time is 39 Steps.
I don't know that show.
Oh, you got to see it. It's a dream of mine to direct it, but it will be hell in a handbasket to do. And you want to talk about really difficult tech. That's also a show with very, very, I don't know if I'd say difficult, but you can be as artistic as you want to be.
Really?
Yeah. The 39 Steps is based off of an Alfred Hitchcock film by the same name. And as you know, probably with most Hitchcocks, those are, you know, very intense.
Yes, but
mystery.
The fact that I don't know Hitchcock, and I'm pretty sure people who listen to this know that I should probably know who's Hitchcock, I'm going to catch a lot of flack. So educate an idiot, please.
Yeah,
tell me about it.
So basically, most Hitchcock films are, you know, your classic film noir mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you go dark and interesting and you get the voice of what's going, you know.
My favorite was the woman who killed her husband with the frozen lamb shank, and then she cooked it and served it to the cops.
Amazing.
And the cop at the end was like, I'm sure the murder weapon is right under our noses.
Yeah, exactly. It's great, great stuff. So this was a play based off of the movie, based off of the same name, but that took it to a complete different direction. And it makes kind of fun of Alfred Hitchcock and film noir in a play sense, and it's a complete farce. It is a cast of roughly, I believe, 112 characters played by 4 actors.
I got a question.
Yeah.
What if you did that live in black and white?
That would be really, really interesting. Like, you're talking like full lighting, makeup, set, everything?
Yep.
That'd be really cool.
There's a theater that's done it. They specialized it.
In black and white theater?
Yeah. I don't remember, but I looked on their website and some of their blogs to like know more about this. They don't, at the time, I haven't looked at it recently, they did not give, they said it was like their secret sauce of how to put that makeup I was looking at some of it and I saw it had to do with certain undertones and overtones of the makeup. And then there had to be some specific type of lighting. I think it was daylight lighting, and they had orange or makeup on, like it was
To reflect.
Yeah, to reflect the blue light to kind of balance out.
That's
like
super interesting.
And the reason I think that is because I saw a picture of one member of the cast, with someone outside of the theater, like by like the entrance or whatever. It might have been that she was blue, like overly blue. I forget, it was one or the other, where they're like the makeup and the light complemented each other to reflect white.
That's really interesting.
Like, that's what in my head made sense. I don't know, but I tried testing it one time. That one test didn't work out so well. It gave me an idea of what doesn't work. But I would love to be able to put on a show in black and white.
That would be really cool. And there are a few things that go in that direction. But when it comes to the 39 steps, it's four actors playing 112 parts. You have the main actor who is only one character the entire time. And he's the main character. You have the second actor who is the main female leads. And I think there's four or five of them. And then you have the final two actors, which are called the two clowns, genderless, play every other character, the other 100 characters in the show. And first of all, the costume changes are constantly boom, 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 boom. The set changes. One of my favorite pieces of the show is there's a moment where they travel. And you know how in some of the older movies, you also have an Indiana Jones where they go to the map and you have the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a projector on the back of the show. And then they like turn down the lights and they project it. And then they do shadow work of the plane and the people as they travel. So you have puppetry involved. You have really crazy sets that are constantly changing, going on and off and on and off and reusing all the same pieces. And it's just hilarious.
Expensive.
Yeah, look, you can do a cheaper version of it, but at the end of the day, you want to do it well, you know?
Right.
I'm a firm believer that you can find cheap ways to make things look expensive, but if you are going to have 50 set pieces that you need to be able to move in a heartbeat, you're also going to need people who really, really good costumers who can sew a half and half, you know, half suit, half dress, and then somebody turns around and they're a different character, whatever they need to be that. So I've seen that in the States. I've seen that in London. One of my favorite shows of all time that I would love to do someday.
It's called 39?
The 39 Steps.
The 39 Steps.
Yeah. There's also, in terms of plays, I'm a sucker for good American classics.
Really?
So I love The Crucible. I love Streetcar Named Desire.
I have never seen Streetcar Named Desire. There's some old movies I haven't watched that I've been starting to watch recently.
Yeah.
Can I tell you one of them?
What is it?
Because I went to film school, and you might laugh at me for this, but 2 months ago, for the first time, I saw Apocalypse Now.
Really?
Yeah.
And what did you think?
Every moment of that movie was like, wow. The earth is ending.
Yeah.
This is what civilization is. But I love that quick cameo that the director did of himself with the cinematographer and production designer. It was why can't I think of the ASC member, the guy who shot it? Vittorio Storaro was a cinematographer. Frank Coppola, the director, and the production designer was, can't remember. Apologies. They had their own cameo in it, and I paused it, and I was like, what? And I looked it up, and then I called my friend, and I was like, is this them in the movie? He was like, yeah, that's where that shot of them in a textbook that you read about when you read about the movie
comes from. There's, what is the famous line at the very end of Apocalypse Now?
I don't remember.
Oh no, it's gonna drive me crazy.
Spoiler alert.
No, it's either it's oh, this is really gonna drive me crazy. I'll look it up. But yeah, Apocalypse Now is one of those musts. You know, I would also love to do a stage version someday. I'm sure this already exists, but I would love to do a stage version of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
That'd be cool. This is the black and white theater I was telling you about.
With the one person in color?
Yeah.
That's
a beautiful red dress.
That's really, really cool. I'd love to do something like that. You know, I think when you talk about the set involved, the makeup, I'm actually almost less worried about, because I think makeup and light you can do, but building the set in a way also that doesn't look cheap.
Yeah.
And also the floor, you know, I oftentimes will work with a theater that I don't own. So
yeah. What can you screw into the floor?
Not just screwing, a legitimate painting question. The floor.
That too.
And, you know.
The traveling theaters here, they don't paint the floor. They travel with their own state, like
Like a mat
every
that
show?
Covers the stage?
No, not even some are mats, but most of them are wood flats. Like really, like
and
just
they
plywood,
on the wood
thick
flat.
Plywood. Like
they
two
drill
foot
them
by
into
3
the stage.
Foot. Yep, we drill them into the stage, and that's the floor.
Nice.
So that every time they know they have the same floor.
That's
like
actually
makes sense. It seems kind of like redundant. Like, hey man, it's whatever. I mean, obviously, it adds to the artistic value of the show because you can control more of what the viewer sees. But also, the actors know exactly where they need to hit their marks and where
right.
things are going to be. And like the chair, like we can mark things. So on this floor, this chair is going to be here at the beginning of the show. Absolutely, 1,000% of the
time.
It
makes a lot more sense when you're talking about travel.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wrote down the 39 steps as well.
39 steps. I really can't say it enough. if you're going to watch a good classic movie, but also the play, you really like Streetcar Named Desire, the Stella, you know, it's so good, but there's actually two versions. First of all, the movie with, the main male lead.
Brando?
Yes, Marlon Brando in his prime is like, wow.
Woo!
Yeah.
I heard that was the movie that like changed acting for people where they looked at his acting and went, oh.
You can do this. Yeah. It was. So that's, first of all, I think a phenomenal movie. But also London Theater, one of the theaters in London, I'm going to get the name wrong, but just did a reprisal of A Streetcar Named Desire. And they did it in a really interesting way because the show is all about looking into the American family in a way that you don't before. You get these glimpses of a little bit of domestic abuse, but love and how, you know, all these pieces, especially if you think about the main female lead, whose name is escaping me and is also driving me crazy. But I always depend on the... oh my god, this is gonna drive me crazy. One of my favorite shows. It will come to me. The Kindness of Strangers. I always depend on the kindness of strangers.
Okay.
Is the famous line that she says. But it's another character who is all smoke and mirrors and his masks and is really losing it underneath. So the whole show is about how you can see something on one side and then when you really dig into it and look what's going on inside the family,
mm-hmm.
It's very different. And a lot of shows of that era, it was very, very indicative of what's really happening behind closed doors. And so they took that idea behind closed doors or behind the walls, and they built a wall-less set. So it was just the bare bones, like the metal outline of a two-story building.
Whoa.
And so you have the floor, obviously, and then they did it in a rotating stage. So
that's complicated.
Yeah, it's theater in the round.
Oh, they meant physically moving stage. Okay,
no,
you did
both,
it in the
both.
Round.
Oh. Theater in the round and a stage that was moving very, very slowly, 360 degrees.
The whole time?
The entire time. Very slowly. So like the actors weren't going to like fall over. But what it meant is that like you're sitting theater in the round and you're looking inside the house at every different angle, which is this underlying motif of the play as well. And I thought it was brilliantly done. So I really love.
That's cool.
Yeah.
When you got the money, spend it on something.
Exactly. If you're a well-funded theater, you better show it off. That's what I think.
Dude, I'm loving how live events now, they can't skimp out.
No.
The bar has been set too high.
100%.
I remember reading about like the first time moving lights were used on a musical tour. What's wrong with me? Anyways, like reading about people's opinion who were there, like from the lighting board operator or something mm-hmm. like that. I'm just like, wow, what is that like? And then like we're around four, like seeing, being able to communicate with these devices, like via our phone.
Yeah.
An iPad.
Yeah.
I can connect things to an app that talks to an iPad and I can just control and test certain things standing in one location on a set with just an iPad.
Yeah.
You can't do everything on an iPad.
But you can do a lot.
You can do a hell of a lot. A hell of a lot. It is awesome the way technology has advanced for production.
Yeah.
It has. What got you into theater? Like can you remember a moment in time as like, I want to be in theater? And from that, what led you to directing?
It's a good question. I think a lot of it happened in high school for me. There were two points that it really clicked. One of them was my grandma would always take me to see shows with her. Mm-hmm. So I would always go to symphony, opera, plays, and theater. So I did enjoy it from a young age. And there is a feeling that you have as a child, you know, not even as a child, I still get it now at the end of a show, where you look at the actors on stage and you go, I want to do that. And originally acting was the thing for me. That was what I wanted to do. That was why I got into theater. I think that this happens to a lot of people who get in because of the enamor of acting and then find another direction. But then when I was in high school, I also, like, it's silly, but, you know, you have to pick an art credit. And I was really bad at actual, like, fine art at drawing. So I was like, I'll go do theater. And it sort of happened by accident. What happened was, it was my sophomore year of high school. I was doing theater one. And I was friends with a lot of the theater kids, you know, the kids who did it on a regular basis. And I decided my freshman year, I didn't go out for anything. But it was actually So it was my sophomore year, we did a show in the fall, which was Oklahoma. We did the musical.
Oklahoma.
And I remember that they were in desperate need of boys. And
who isn't,
right? All the time. And I wanted to, it was one of those things where if I auditioned as a guy, I wouldn't have gotten in. But I was also doing tennis at the time, and I wanted to try out for the tennis team. And the auditions were the week before tennis tryouts. So it just so happened that if I auditioned and I got in, which I knew I would because they needed guys, I would feel like a jerk if then I made the tennis team and I dropped out of the show. And I didn't think that was fair to the director. So I didn't audition in the end. And I remember I saw all of my friends in Oklahoma and I was so jealous that they were doing it.
Were you doing tennis?
No, I didn't make the team. I made it to the last day of tryouts. And let's set this right. I'm going to set the record straight real quick. I made it to the final day of tryouts. You know, they cut the bottom people every day. I got to the last day. There's only 10 people there left. There are 10 spots on the team. I'm like, I'm going to make it. This is awesome. I worked really hard for this. And I was in spot 10 of 10. And then Mitchell Victor walks up.
Shout out to Mitchell Victor.
And he was a club player. Like, he played at clubs. And so he didn't come into the tryouts because he thought he would be busy. And then he wasn't busy. And he was a good player. So he came to the last day of tryouts, which you weren't supposed to do, and then showed up. And because he was good, the coach was like, yeah, of course you can just try out. And he had to kick one person out, and I was the person to get kicked out.
Oh, man.
So I didn't
get
to do it.
He was so good. He was the coach was just like, of course. Like, yeah. There's been a spot for you.
Exactly.
No, I was waiting for you to just walk through the door.
They didn't have to have this loser on the team, but... So the next year we actually did, I started in tech. The next year we did a show called Ruthless.
Okay.
Which, if you haven't heard of before, phenomenal show.
Never heard of it.
It was only ever off Broadway. It's a cast of 9 women. And potentially one of the roles can be played by a man in drag.
Okay.
And it's basic. It's kind of like a spoof of Gypsy. It's almost like a spoof of Gypsy or a spoof. A spoof of, like, one of the songs is called I Hate Musicals. Very self-aware.
I've come up with an idea for a musical. I'll tell you in a minute. Continue.
So Ruthless, really, really fun show. It's about a little girl named Tina who gets cast as the understudy in her school play. And so she kills the lead. By the way, this is her third grade school play. So she kills the lead so she can get it, and then gets arrested, and her mom becomes a star in the it's a very, very funny musical, and we got adjudicated for it and went to the state conference to perform it.
Whoa.
And I remember I was doing tech. I was on the prop crew, you know, because I auditioned for the drag role and didn't get it. And I remember even standing backstage, the feeling of 2,000 people laughing and screaming and cheering for the show was one of the most infectious, crazy things. And it was really awesome. Shortly after that, I got into acting. I kept on auditioning in school, and I got cast in Macbeth as Macbeth, which was, yeah, you know, my still where I peaked.
Don't say that.
Yeah, no. and I started working as an actor shortly after that. So I started doing just looking for gigs, commercials, wherever I could, because I enjoyed it. I did a couple different. I did a reality TV show pilot. I did.
What was the reality TV show pilot?
It was for a show called Foodball, which was meant to be like football, but with food. So it was like a kids cooking show.
That's awesome.
It was a lot of fun, except I think I got paid $100 for it. You know, like
not much money in that for a kid.
No, but it was a fun event. And they actually ended up selling the pilot to a network, and it did go on pretty successfully in local television, but
nice.
Not my episode. They redid it all. But and I did a few commercials, and I worked around, and I kind of got the idea. I really loved auditioning.
Really?
Yeah, which most people hate it, but there's something fun about going to an audition for me, and like the nerves that you would get, and like, am I gonna get it? Am I gonna do it?
I get that with interviewing. Like, yeah. I enjoy interviewing.
I don't feel the same way. Because when I was auditioning, it's like I was younger, and it wasn't a matter of, will I be able to pay my bills because of this? It was just, I'm doing this because I like it and it's fun. And if I don't get the part, I don't get the part. But oftentimes, I was in a pretty good place with it, actually. But as far as the transition to directing, sorry, yeah. I'm rambling.
Quite no, it's cool. Don't worry about it.
So anyways, transition to director. Yeah.
Yes.
Also it started in high school. I had a friend, Savannah, that we wrote plays together. The first play we wrote was originally called Gigolo. Just so you get, like, it's also very farcical if you like my style. It was a play where, I haven't talked about this in a long time. For her 18th birthday, her mom set her up on a date with the boy next door. But her best friend bought her a male stripper, and the date and the stripper come at the same time. And so she's running back and forth between the two.
That's hilarious.
That was, the first show we wrote. And the second one was called Letters. Also very farcical. It was a lot of fun. It was a 12-person cast. You played with 6 people. Mm-hmm. So everyone had 2 roles that were very different. And this was the first show I directed, because like it was my final project in high school. And the idea there was, first of all, of course, knowing myself now, I find it very funny because it's very me that I was like, yes, for my first thing, I'm going to have 6 actors that I'm going to have to train to be 2 different characters each, do physicality on all these separates. I'm going to give them all quick changes of like 30 seconds, less than 30 seconds. The basic concept was that it took place in this mansion, and the young girl who's inheriting the wealth of her parents has narcolepsy.
Oh.
And everyone's there, but no one knows she's narcoleptic, and they see her and they assume that she's dead, and then everyone's trying to hide the body so they can inherit the will. So lots of physical comedy with, like, you open the closet, like the maid opens the closet to get the broom.
Yeah.
But somebody hid the dead girl in there, and then she falls on the maid, and then the maid, like,
that happens in The Show Goes Wrong.
Does it really?
wait, you didn't see it?
I have. Oh, I'm seeing it.
I thought you saw it. Oh, no. My God.
We were ahead of our time, you know?
No, I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay.
No, that was a dick move.
It's okay. It's okay. I'll still enjoy it. Trust me.
You will. You will.
So that was the first show I directed, and it was like a high school project. It wasn't such a big deal, but I'll never forget the feeling of, I had been on shows, I had done acting, I had been on live stages, and you bow at the end and you have a lot of fun. But the feeling was completely different for me from when I was sitting, you know, with the tech watching the show, and like just kind of the well of pride that I felt for what I was seeing on stage and what I had created was something completely unlike acting. I still like acting. I still have a lot of fun acting, almost as more of a hobby. But when I direct a show, and it's funny because Nir, my partner, will say all the time that like I come home oftentimes and I'm like, grumpy, these fucking actors, this and that. Like, I don't look like I'm, you know, necessarily all smiles all the time. It's difficult, and times it can be very trying, but nothing compares to that feeling that I get personally when I see what I was able to create and put together at the end. It's really a remarkable feeling for me, and that's kind of what pushed me in that direction. And then after I left high school and went on to the rest of my life, I just continued doing it.
Is it the aspects of like your ideas of how these characters should flow, and then being able to connect with the human that has to play this character, and how you get them to connect with that, to for you to mold the stage in a way where like you see the movements and you see these moments where you can have a character do something? And it's not about like demanding an actor do something. It's about having the character itself, who's part of this show, interacting with other characters, create this flow.
Yeah, I think there's two parts of it. For me, directing starts when I read a script. It starts when I'm going over and I start to create an image in my mind. And I think this is for any artist.
I can't not do that when reading a script in terms of lighting.
100%.
When I look at that, it's like, okay, interior day. I'm like, all right, well, that's like half my information.
Right?
But then walking through that, it's easy. It makes the first discussion between creative heads so much easier if everyone's read the script.
100%.
And has that mindset of being able to, at least the first time, think like, put yourself not in the mind of the viewer, but as someone who needs to know how to come up with the solutions to make this look right.
Right.
And that's what you have to, I think that's the hat you need to wear when reading the script, 100%. Even the first time.
And I think also, there are lots of hints. My favorite thing is, you know, you get a lot of different writers who are very specific with their stage direction and like, you need to make the show look exactly like this.
Okay.
And I like, you know, I appreciate that. I respect it, but I also respectfully depart from that at times. And I think that there's a lot of, when you're reading a script, I love reading between the lines. I love like finding, you see this actor said this specific thing, so we need to make sure that we are changing the lighting here and emoting this. And, you know, like finding those nuggets that create moments of real awe in a show. Those are like the exciting pieces for me.
You know who is at the top of my list of someone who can do that no matter the medium?
Who?
Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
In my opinion, film, theater, television.
For sure.
He's really knocked it out of the park in terms of being able to take the ideas he has, create the environment he needs to create for that art to happen, and capture it in a way that audiences love rewatching.
100%. What television has Mel Brooks done?
What television?
Yeah.
Why can't I remember? Oh, he used to do the Sid Caesar show. He was a writer on the Sid Caesar show with Carl Reiner and Neil Simon and Woody Allen. Yeah. So like Sid Caesar show. Mm. Did you ever watch any of those old timey shows?
Not really.
He has a joke that still kills.
Yeah.
Yeah. From Sid Caesar. I don't know who wrote this scene, but it's they're directing a silent movie, and like you see like these dramatic movements, this and that, and like during a take, during a break, like they cut and they're resetting to do another take, and someone comes in and says that they're now going to add sound, and this whole movie is going to be part of the talkies, and people will be able to hear the actors. And one of the main actress of the star of this pretend movie in the set comes up and says, I can't wait for people to be able to hear my beautiful voice and know what it is I'm trying to say. And then the main star of the show comes up and puts his arm around the main actress and the producer or director. And he says, oh, boy, I can't wait for everyone to hear my voice. Like, it still lands.
It still works, yeah.
There are a few jokes from back then that still work. But like all those guys, those Those guys, the reason, like, yeah, I don't know how else to say it. I think it's like the Sid Caesar show created a whole new generation of writers.
Yeah.
That was able to pass knowledge down up until, like, even the 90s. Let's take Mel Brooks for the example. Mm-hmm. Like, you can go from Sid Caesar show to other sketch comedy shows that came along, mm-hmm. and keep going down the line. But, like, Mel Brooks put out the producers.
Right.
And to this day, they still have more Tonys than Hamilton, if I'm not correct.
By one. I wouldn't be surprised.
By one, I believe.
You can't beat Springtime for Hitler.
Dude, that was amazing. My dad is the one that introduced me to that.
Really?
Yeah. I never went to go see it, though. I don't think I ever went to see the stage version. I only saw the film.
I haven't seen the stage version either.
You only saw the film?
Yep.
All right. If you and I ever have a chance to go see Producers together.
That'd be a good one.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Is it even touring right now?
I don't know. Producers would be a fun one to see. You heard of One Man, Two Governors? I would love to see that too. Another farcical comedy. For me, I either want like as drama gets or a farce. Like, I want to go to the end of comedy.
Why do you like comedy so much over like drama?
Oh, I don't. If I love watching farce specifically, like slapstick style, ridiculous.
Steve Martin, over the top.
Love it, love it, love it. And also physical comedy. Like, I really, really enjoy it. If you're asking me what would I prefer to direct, it would be drama in a heartbeat.
Okay.
And it's sometimes difficult because I feel that drama does not sell as well as comedy does, which is why a lot of people, I think, prefer comedy. Because especially when you're in a production environment, You can't be ignorant of what is going to sell.
Right.
You know? That being said, you do have professional theaters putting out dramas all the time that do really well. But especially when you're working in a community theater and you're trying not to lose money, if I was going to do a drama, I'd probably have to go on the lighter side of it. You know, I saw...
Nobody here wants to see a hardcore drama.
But sometimes they... Like, the people... do not think about the catharsis, like the cathartic moment you get from drama.
Hamilton did that for me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
In terms of like which part?
Actually, I will tell you, there's not even being a part of a show, like watching a show, a part of a show. There was a show, an event that I did that made me feel that.
Mm.
It was a private like bar mitzvah wedding, whatever, in the Tower of David.
Oh, nice.
They rented out that whole area. Private VIP party.
Hope they paid you well.
I got paid pretty well. The projectors, there was projection mapping across the entire top of it. They built a cut like a stage to be able to like have like great DJ music and lighting.
Wow.
They built a custom 360 ring with lights and video screens on it, so you could actually like create lighting effects directly from the stage. And we had lights from the Archer Towers.
That's awesome.
As well. And I'm going up and down these stairs that are thousands of years old. Maybe thousands. I don't know. 1,000 and a half? I don't know the time. They are very old stairs.
Right.
And if the people who built them saw what we are doing now, they would think what we are doing is magic.
Yeah. 100%.
And I was like, this is weird. It was like the one time where like there's a lot of big venues, important venues. But like for me, that was the most impactful venue.
Yeah,
because of what you were talking about.
No, it is one of those, like, I think venues are also, when you talk about directing and production, venues take such a big role in that too.
Yeah.
It's one of the things where I would love to do a more classic show in like the amphitheater in Yafo or something that is outdoors.
Really?
Yeah, because I think if you're gonna do a classic, do it. Like, there are two ways you can do it.
Do it Greek.
No, so you can either
no
go full classic, right? You can go full classic, which I think, you know, would be fun to do outdoor in an amphitheater, or you can do in a much more modern version of it, which I think is also very fun to see at times. But one of the best productions of Hamlet that I saw, for example, it was in a theater and it had a single wall. That was their set, and they had a few chairs and things they brought on at times that were like period. But what I love that they did with that is they turned it, they used it however they need it. It was just this wall. I even think it broke into two and then went back together, but that was it. And it was done in such a creative way that also for me was saying, you know, if I see something like Hamlet in this really over the top set of these, of the throne room and the area for the players. And like, ultimately, these shows are written in a way where they weren't as considerate of set because there was very little set. And if you compare it to things now, for example, like you can take Streetcar, you can take, I recently read August Osage County, which was also a really nice play to read. I would love to do that sometime.
Okay.
But when you have shows like this, they're written in the context of, I know I want to get this on somewhere and there's going to be a set and I have a number of rooms that I need to make. And like, for, you can also take the same example if you look at Vanya, Masha. Oh, I don't remember the other two names, but it's a play that was on Broadway recently-ish, 6-7 years ago. It's four names of Chekhov characters. I'll find the name of it.
The three sisters?
No, all from different. Vanya from Uncle Vanya.
Ah, Vanya from Uncle Vanya. Okay.
Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike by Christopher Durang.
Those characters mixed together in a show.
So it's just the name of those characters, and the concept is that like their deceased father or mother was a big fan of Chekhov, so he named all of his kids after. Nice. Also a very silly, very fun show. But if you look at every production of the show, all of the sets look near identical. And it's something that I've really struggled with because, like, even when we did Rumors recently, because at the end of the day, I want to do this show with a good set and I want the set to make sense. And I also want to respect the source material that says you have three doors, you have this, you have that, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time, I want to say, I think it's your duty as a director, producer, whoever, to come in with your unique image. You know, otherwise, you're losing something if you're just copying what somebody else has done.
Correct.
So it's difficult for me when I see a show that is so specific in the way that it's written.
Yeah.
That every production I see of it is built the exact same.
That's tight tolerances.
Yeah. And it's the kind of thing where you say, okay, well, the actors, the director, the lighting, all of these pieces are different. Maybe the set doesn't have to be different.
Okay.
But ultimately, you know, if you want to go real postmodern on it and talk from like a literary point of view about like death of the author and this idea, I really think plays embody that more than any piece of literature. This idea that like, are you familiar with the concept?
Death of the author?
Yeah. So... I did a literature degree, which is why this comes up.
I think this is getting beyond my understanding as to why I love doing this.
So I'll tell you, keep going. Death of the Author, it's a concept written by Roland Barthes, which is basically saying that like in a postmodern concept, when you're reading literature, the author's intention doesn't matter anymore. Like you used to say when you read literature, what did the author mean here? And what this postmodern concept is saying, like, it doesn't matter what the author meant. The author's dead. The author, you know, like if you take something like you have all these people who are upset about J.K. Rowling being like a TERF and not necessarily trans friendly and whatnot. And how can you still appreciate? How can you still for people who have a problem with it? You say, how do I still appreciate Harry Potter, this book that I love, when I know the author is maybe not supportive of me? And if you take it from like a death of the author perspective,
okay.
Once it's written, it has nothing to do with her. It's out there. You don't think about the influence that it has. You think about the new conceptual feeling that it takes. And I think nothing embodies that more than a play.
Really?
Because a play is a source material that you get. And to me, the author does, you know, the playwright does write down stage direction. But like I said, there are times when I choose to respectfully ignore them. When I buy the rights to this play, nobody is coming knocking on my door saying, the stage direction has three doors and you only built two.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
I have full artistic power there to kind of say how I think it should be built. So that's why I bring up the literary concept, because when I take a play, to me, the playwright is important. It's important to me that The Crucible was written in the context of the Red Scare, and I don't want to ignore that. But when I want to take it and apply it to my current time period and place that I'm in, I don't care as much why or where it was written as much as I do how does it apply to the show I'm creating. So that's more of, I don't know why I started talking about this, but
no, it's cool. This is really in depth.
I love experimental theater.
Yeah.
That plays with actors who don't know what they're doing. There's a play called An Oak Tree that I really want to put on in a Fringe style. Two actors, one of them,
I've heard about this. Tell me again.
Yeah, so one of them knows what he's doing. Basically, one of the actors is plays the therapist in The Oak Tree. Memorized, knows what he's doing. The other one is a guest. It's a guest that you invite, and he gets a script when he or she comes in, and they read the script live on stage with the actor playing the therapist. So it's like you're in a therapy session, and you, as an actor, are reading along, not knowing the story at all. And you are acting and going through the story live on stage as it unfolds.
Have you seen the theater? I wouldn't say fringe theater, but because it's got decent spacing on the stage and height in Bat Yam.
I have not.
Yeah. In South Bat Yam on Koma Miut, next to these big towers across the street from a Russian supermarket, there is a theater in Bat Yam that has two stages.
Okay.
And a full lighting setup. And in the middle, a lounge and a bar. I met the guy who runs the lounge and bar. And they named the bar after him. But yeah, I got, he showed me a tour of the small stage, which in terms of height, it's like a warehouse. So you have like all the height you need.
Nice.
You can bring in huge set pieces if you wanted.
Yeah.
I never checked the rates because I didn't know anyone who wanted to put on a show there.
I mean, but yeah.
You could take the number one to get there.
You can. I think
it's not close, but you know what?
Look, I don't live in the center of town either. But my question also when I'm considering, and this is something that comes up for me a lot, running an organization in a foreign language in a country, you know?
Where's the audience?
Where is the audience and who's going to come? And it's one of the things I hate the most.
Yeah, I know.
Because
it's the most unartistic aspect about this.
Yeah. And that was the thing, like, and that's why I say I love doing drama.
Yeah.
I don't do it much because I worry about getting an audience. Because the thing is, you don't have a ton of English theater goers here as much as you do English speakers who would be willing to go see a comedy at the theater if you pull them in enough. So I personally, I have a subscription to the Camry.
You do?
Mm-hmm. Because Nir and I, we go and see the shows. Sometimes on Tuesday nights they do with English subtitles.
Nice.
So first of all, it's good for my Hebrew. And second of all, it's really good for just studying. There is no second of all. Second of all, I love theater. And they do
couldn't have guessed.
They do some really, really good shows there. And they have theater goers. That's the thing. In your native language, you have a good enough audience of theater goers. But I don't think here, and maybe I'm naive, at least in my 4 or 5 years of putting on shows here, I don't think there's a big enough audience to have, like a subscription style thing in the same way
for English speaking theater.
Yeah, we've done.
No, it's not. It doesn't exist. There's not enough audience before you have an audience saturation.
Yeah,
where the same people have already seen it twice.
Yeah,
how many are going to come back to see it a third time?
So that's the thing. We had two shows now with around 400 people coming. Like two different shows that we did. We did Rumors and Miscast. Both of them had around 400 people in the audience. And there were different people, by the way. Like of those 400, I'd probably say maybe 200 were the same. But it means that like half the audience was different for each show, which is really interesting. But it does seem like that's kind of the cap as far as how many people we can get.
Yeah.
So if I'm talking doing a small theater, multiple performances, awesome. But when you want to do a show in a big theater that sits 200 people and you're going to pay for the space, it's hard to do something that is running, you know?
Can I tell you something about 200-seat theater?
What?
It's not big.
Oh, I know it's not big. Trust me, I know it's not big.
I know what you mean, though. But for this audience size, it's huge.
Yeah, that's
like
the thing.
Like at ZOA, they have some good-sized theaters there.
Yeah.
But it's like the audience saturation even there happens quick.
Yeah. And I do wonder, when you look at a place like the Camry, they do really well in terms of I saw a show, Horse Walks Into a Bar, David Grossman. We saw that show in 2018. Yeah, we saw the show in 2018, and it's still running. I think they do it once a month or so.
Really?
But they do well. And there is an English show at the Camry called The Wandering Israeli.
Okay.
Which has been going on for a few years, more than a few years now. It's been going on for 4 or 5 years now as well. And he does a good job, and he still sells, doesn't sell out, but he sells a decent amount, and he puts it on once a month. And the reason he does a decent amount is because, first of all, it's a show that tourist English speakers would enjoy. That's one. You know, if I'm a tourist, why would I come and see a production of Neil Simon in Israel when I can go see it back at home? It's a good question. But this is something that's like specifically Israel themed, about, you know, an Israeli adolescent, Ole, whatever. So that's one. Two, he does the show in English, Hebrew, and Spanish. So he does it in three different languages, and I'm pretty sure he does them back to back to back in the same night. So it's about an hour and 20 minute show. It's not a super long show.
Okay.
But he does,
exhausting.
It's exhausting. But I think that's, they basically say, okay, you have the theater from like 5 p.m. until the end of the night.
Yeah.
You need to sell enough to
cover your expenses. Spot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Prove to us that we shouldn't be giving it to someone else.
You know the Marx Brothers?
Like Marxism?
No, Marx Brothers, like Groucho.
Oh, yeah, Harpo. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Dude, my father, the first comedians I was ever introduced to by my father was the Three Stooges and the Marx Brothers. And Harpo Marx was the first clown I'd ever known. I never knew someone that could be a clown. I was like, that's a goofy person. So in their documentary, the point of me rambling on about this, they were known before they went and shot film. They needed to know what bits were going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So they rented out a theater and would do 5 shows a day.
Wow.
To figure out where the laughs are and how to make it better.
And a lot of, you hear that from actually a lot of trained comedians as well.
Yeah.
You know, they're going and they do random bars. They pop up just to test new material and see how it works, how it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But, you know, clowning is really a talent.
It is.
It's holy one of the cow. Reasons, by the way, that I love the 39 Steps, because of those two clowns. They're really clowning throughout the show.
It's hard to be a good clown.
Very hard.
My wife's afraid of clowns.
Yeah, but, you know, clowning in this sense isn't the same in that way.
She doesn't like it.
No, I haven't seen it. I do actually want to read it at some point, even though I'm not the biggest Stephen King fan.
Really?
Yeah, I've read a few.
He gets kind of dark, depending on where you want to go. I will say the first thing I was introduced, though, from Stephen King was Pet Sematary, the movie.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is bizarre.
It's really interesting because, you know, horror tends to get a different categorization than fantasy. But a lot of Stephen King's horror is really fantastical. You know, it's the horror and the fantastic.
Right.
And it is very, very interesting. I read The Shining, and, you know, they have a new one that they're coming out with for Stephen King as well.
I haven't seen The Shining in forever.
I haven't either, but I read the book 2 years ago for Halloween or something. I decided I wanted to read a good horror story.
All right.
And it does the slow build well. I will give it that. But I didn't love it, which was kind of a disappointment. I know that Stephen King himself, is not a fan of the movie because of how the changes that Kubrick made to it.
Oh, Kubrick.
One of my favorite directors.
Can you separate art from the man?
That is a good question, because he has such a distinct stamp that he put on everything he did.
He did?
And I don't know if you can. Like, 2001 A Space Odyssey is one of my favorite movies of all time. And there's just something about it that is so distinct. You know,
it's just, you know, it's him.
100%.
Yeah.
I as a side note to that, new film that recently came out, Everything Everywhere All at Once. You get a chance to see it?
Nope.
Do it immediately. Is like the I have not left a movie theater. I leave a theater more often going wow than I do a movie theater. But this was the first time I left the movie theater saying wow. Like, that was easily one of my top 10 films of all time.
Really?
Yeah. And there's a Space Odyssey reference in it, which is why one led to the other.
Gotcha.
But yeah.
I recently saw a, sure you didn't see it. It's the new Chip and Dale reunion reboot movie.
I did not see it.
It came out this year. Stars Andy Samberg.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And Mulaney, John Mulaney. That's Chip and Dale.
Nice.
Yeah. And it's just this, I found it less comedic than it was like a love letter to cartoons.
That's nice, though. I mean, especially for like you as an older audience member going to see it.
Yeah, because like I'm looking at this going, some of these people who are involved with this have done like, did you watch The Boys?
The Amazon show?
Yeah.
Haven't seen it yet.
Okay. There's this a group of people made a cartoon version, like a love letter to 90s cartoons. And it was unbelievably graphic in terms of like, oh, this is cute. And this little kid has laser eyes.
Yeah.
Okay. You know how Cyclops had from X-Men had laser eyes. And you're always wondering, what could Cyclops do with those laser eyes when he really hit somebody? Yeah. Yeah. They animated that in a 1990s-ish like cartoon goofy oversaturated way. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. They did that also with another cartoon. I don't remember the name of it, but it was like they put a bunch of classic cartoon characters in a reality TV show.
Mm-hmm.
It was very fun. It was like you had Betty Boop and Chip and Dale and a few other ones, but then they made it very raunchy and ridiculous like most reality TV shows.
I respect people for wanting to make money. I really do. Listen, if you figure out a way to create content that makes money, by all means, be you, go do you. Mm-hmm. But there's something about reality TV shows, I'm just like, I gotta take a step back. It's just like sometimes this forced drama that it feels like, and then you hear about some side stories come out in magazines or documentaries about what was it really like behind the scenes and on the set, and like how chaotic some of it really was, and then how some of it was all made up and some of it was completely fabricated. So it's like, what do you believe? And like, where is this draw? It's like, for me, it's like too much. Mm. Like, I'd rather just get lost in a completely different story, fantasy, or series.
Reality television to me is almost a little like Cirque du Soleil on TV in the sense that like, no, but I really do. Because I studied this a while ago. Like, I actually think reality television is negative or harmful for the theater industry, or like the theater industry, the reading industry, basically anything that's a slow burn, because
why?
Because reality television, it does well giving you a spectacle the entire time. They give you excitement after excitement after excitement after excitement. That's what they do. Some of it's completely fabricated, but it's in the same way that, and when I say it's negative, it's the same way that soap operas are, that you watch a soap opera. And why do you watch it? Because it's excitement after excitement after excitement after excitement. You don't watch it for like the, oh, okay, that was nice. You know, some shit needs to hit the fan somewhere. And that's also a really nice cathartic moment. But I think you then get people going to a theater and seeing something live and getting bored and going like, oh, yeah, but when is the stuff going to happen? Like
I get what you mean.
The normal, or maybe the intricacies of these relationships and whatnot, and I think especially with drama, gets lost a little bit because it's not 0 to 100 right away. And
I got you.
And I think also like the other side of that is concerts as well have really, really changed. Like, for example,
you can't show up with a bad show nowadays.
No, but it's more than that. Like my mom and my sister went and saw Coldplay and Adele on the same weekend. It was my mom's birthday weekend. They bought tickets to both.
That sounds fantastic.
It was. And they saw, and what was interesting was loved Coldplay and disappointed by Adele. And
to each their own.
No, but my mom, like, they love Adele, but the reasoning, Coldplay was a spectacle. And it wasn't just in the sense that you have an exciting show with the cameras and whatnot, but everybody also has the wristbands that are changing colors the entire time. You feel like you're a part of the show. Whereas with Adele, she was kind of standing there singing. And it almost felt like less of an excitement. And you wonder, like, if these shows keep on upping the bar in terms of how involved and exciting, what happens to just the guy playing piano at the bar? You know, like, is that enough anymore for people? And it's a good question.
It's true.
It's a dangerous question to ask in a way, because you hope it is, especially for those of us that work in production. You don't want to have to make something over the top just for the sake of it being over the top.
Yeah, we were talking about that at the beginning, and I agree with you. Like, it needs to fit the story. There should be a reason to fit the story. Going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, not having a spectacle for the sake of a spectacle. Yeah, I totally agree with that. To repeat myself a second time. And I just don't know what I wanted to say after that. Can't remember my train of thought.
It's okay.
Never mind. I do love working on big shows, though. It makes you feel like, as crew, you're a part of something huge. Yeah,
for sure. For sure.
Huge. Like, for me, I love it when it's complicated, time-consuming, and it's confusing to most people.
Yeah.
I love it when it's not straightforward. I really do.
I hear that. I do enjoy it when you hear some people saying, like when they're walking out and they're like, how did they do that? You know, that I love it.
I had that happen on a movie set.
Really?
Yeah. I was in Detroit, and the camera that we were using, I knew it didn't have a large amount of dynamic range. It's how many stops of light, mm-hmm. you know, from one to the next before it can't see anything either from dark or light stuff, mm-hmm. whichever.
I actually only know that because of video games, but continue.
Okay, cool. So, we had a monster. We were filming a horror movie in Detroit in an abandoned building.
As one does.
Yes. So the monster, I figured out where the actors were going to walk. I figured out what was going to be like their closest part of their head to these lights hanging over the head of them. I switched out the light bulbs to like lower powered light bulbs. And then I took a piece of cloth, you know, like a piece of black cloth,
mm-hmm.
and blacked out like where the actor was standing. So, where the light was hitting the actor hiding behind this wall,
mm-hmm.
a little bit. And literally, as the main characters walk by, this creature just peeks its head out through the darkness. Just following them. And on the monitor, you can't see his body. You just see his head literally appear from a black hole in space.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
And people off to the side looking at the monitor going, but how did you do that? I see him right here.
That's really awesome.
And it's like, when you can find those little moments, it's like, I'm so happy I'm not in a cubicle today.
Yeah, 100%. And then, I don't know about you, but then I actually do go to my cubicle at times. And I'm like, God damn it.
I have a desk as well. I wouldn't call it a cubicle.
No, I don't either.
It's just a row of desks. Not bad. I do. Have you seen the movie Office Space?
I don't think so.
What? You've never seen Office Space? Three employees working in an office and things go wrong?
Sounds very familiar.
They beat up a printer?
It sounds very, very... Maybe I have seen it. How old is it?
90s.
Maybe I have seen it. But if I have, I don't explicitly remember seeing it.
All right. Never mind. It is absolutely outlandish. I highly recommend that. Do you know of any good shows that are coming this summer to Israel that are touring? Because I know that Cats has come through in the past.
You said good shows?
I hadn't seen Cats until since I was my daughter's age.
Okay.
It had been a while.
And you remembered it as amazing, yeah?
It was all right.
No, I'm saying when you saw it when you were younger.
Yeah, I remember it being great. And then it stopped, the and it's thing. Like, no more cats.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I always wanted to see cats again. And then they tried doing the movie, which had some very...
big names in it.
Big names and big technical problems. Like, you could see, instead of cat paws, you saw hands and fingers some places. It was not the best release.
No.
And none of the actors, like, you know, the tours that people do, like, on the show, on shows, like, the promotional tours. So, no one's doing a post-release tour that movie.
No one is talking about it, no. I don't actually know of a good touring cast coming shortly. I have seen a couple, but there's not a lot of touring shows that come to Israel, I feel like.
They are. They're just not. There's some are. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Compared to the rest of the world, like.
Yeah, well, no. When I Europe, when I lived in Arizona, like, and you go over to Gamage and they have
Gamage. Woo, Gamage was a beautiful, beautiful
such
space.
A nice
the Cupcake. I love that's a beautiful name for it too. The Cupcake.
Yeah.
I
used to go to Gamage once a month and see whatever touring show was coming. Like,
they always had great theater.
Yeah,
and that's hilarious. Like, it never went to like downtown or some other place. Like, no, it went to the college. Like, if you wanted good theater, this college had amazing theater. And if you worked in their theater program, you could be able to you might be able to help crew some of those traveling shows.
Really? That I didn't know.
I've heard. I don't know firsthand.
Right.
It just depends. Like, there's unions, and Arizona is not a union state, but also you have people who are kids who are studying there that want to learn this. So it's like, can you use them in terms of labor laws if they want to work as an intern, so to speak?
Ah, interesting.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe it's like extra educational credits. I don't know.
Potentially.
Someone explained to me who knew. Doesn't matter. It's basically hearsay at this point. I might be talking nonsense.
No, but there are actually a lot of good theaters in Arizona. So. Touring shows there, you know, you see tons. I wish there were more here. I saw Chicago when it was touring over here.
How was it?
It was pretty fun. It was like the set was unique in that, like, they had a staircase, just like a full staircase in the middle of the stage that they used quite a bit. And then on the sides of the staircase, they had the orchestra. And I love when you have an onstage orchestra.
Yes.
It's just so, like,
big band music,
too. Yeah. Because they're really into it, and like, it makes sense for a show like Chicago that they would do it.
I know.
But I love in musicals when they incorporate it into the show.
See, that's a part where you were talking about going over the top just for the sake of going over the top. It's like, that adds an element that you don't see anymore. It's a specific time period.
100%.
It's a specific flavor of show. It's not, it's like a throwback to a whole different time when shows were done.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. For that, it's not, I've always seen it from like the lighting perspective of those types of shows. It's not about the light. Just make sure there's light on stage.
Yeah.
And just let whoever's about to start dancing or whatever they do, you know, there's no lighting changes when Fred Astaire is full frame on camera.
Yeah.
You watch some Fred Astaire movies?
And
you know Fred Astaire? He's the famous tap dancer who did like movies.
Yeah, but like, which, give me some film names.
Oh, why can't I remember them at the moment? It was in his contracts, I heard, that he would be shot full frame so that you would be able to see. I heard. I've never seen his contract.
I love tap dancing. I actually took tap dancing when I was younger.
Really?
I wanted to be in a musical that needed tap dance, and then I got cast in the musical as the only part that doesn't tap dance.
Really?
Yeah. But it was still a good part. It was Thoroughly Modern Millie. It was a fun show. I don't think it will ever be produced again because of the racial undertones to it. But I played a Chinese character, and all of my lines were in Mandarin.
What? Yeah. You had to memorize your Mandarin lines?
I had to memorize Mandarin, and I remember it was funny because the show basically just fucks with people. Like, the all of my words were in Mandarin, and all my songs were in Cantonese, which means it basically didn't make any sense, but, you know, whatever. And so I was in full yellow face. Like, not really, like, we'll leave it. But the girl who played my sister was Chinese, and she actually spoke Mandarin. And I remember that it was one day during tech week, like, and I just didn't have one of the lines down.
Yeah.
So I just made up fake Chinese. I was like, the director doesn't know what's Chinese and what's not Chinese. So I just made up fake Chinese. And the girl playing my sister froze on stage because she was actually going off of my Chinese. So when I made up fake Chinese, she got so confused because she was like, he just spoke gibberish. She like understood all of my lines. And I was like, just keep going. Don't let it, like, don't show
the
it.
The show must go on.
Exactly. Man, that was a trip, though. That was such a fun show.
Fred Astaire, Holiday Inn, Follow the Fleet, The Gay Divorcee. Okay. I'm sure about happy. Funny Face, The Pleasure of His Company, The Sky is the Limit, Damsel in Distress, Blue Skies. I know Blue Skies. Anyways, yeah, Tap Dancing Freak. Just wanted to, in a
I
good way,
tap.
Like he just
I
wanted to.
Tap.
Do you think you could tap dance? And then you saw Fred Astaire, you'd be like, oh, at that time in the 50s. No. I'm sure like everyone nowadays, that's like tap dancing 101.
Oh, for sure.
But, you know, back then, it's like how many other people were able to dance like that? There was one tap dancer in all of Hollywood. Maybe that's because they didn't want to and there wasn't enough.
They were like, there's only
saturation.
There's only room for one of us.
Market. They hit market saturation on the tap dancers.
For sure.
Dude, I have always been a fan of comedy.
Yeah?
Yeah. My father, I think, turned me on to that, about being a fan of comedy. First stand-up I've ever went to go see was at Cleveland Playhouse Square. You ever been to Cleveland Playhouse?
Mm-mm.
So the Cleveland Playhouse, like Broadway tours also go through there. It is five different theaters, and it is, like, when you walk in there, if you were to wear, like, a 1930s, like, tuxedo, you'd look up at the walls and be like, yeah, this makes sense. Like, it is absolutely a piece of history.
That's awesome.
Major shows toured through there, and the first time I ever saw stand-up was there. My father took me to see George Carlin.
Wow.
And this was just after I'd found out who George Carlin was. He had done Back in Town at the Beacon. I had never, and I saw it on HBO, and I had no idea what was stand-up. I had no idea it was George Carlin, and I watched this thing, and I went to go and get my hair cut the next day, and the woman who... cutting my hair, I was trying to talk to her about this, and I was like, I actually don't remember anything that I just saw. I have no idea what I just saw.
Right.
What did I just see? And my dad got me introduced, like, took me to George Carlin when he was here, Three Stooges, Marx Brothers, the Sid Caesar show.
That's awesome.
Mel Brooks. Like, I was allowed to watch all of Mel Brooks's movies.
That's
like, not without anyone sitting next to me giving me context. I don't know why.
You were like, yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. So comedy was like a really big factor for me in that. But now I want to switch myself from like the tech to like focusing on the business side of things, like producing and managing production. Yeah. That's really where my goal is and why I want to talk with people just about art and how they view shows and things like that. Anyways, do you have anything else you want to talk about? I feel like we had a good talk.
Nah, it was great. I loved it.
Awesome.
Thanks for making it all the way to the end of this episode of the podcast. This podcast is not sponsored in any way, so please like, share, and subscribe. I'll be releasing an episode every week, so make sure to come back for more. Thanks for listening, and stay creative.